You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Ed Suzeski, is the author of A Christian Survival Guide, Coffeehouse Theology, and other books. His writing has appeared in Christianity Today and Leadership Journal, and he blogs regularly at Patheos. Suzeski founded the Contemplative Writer website and leads contemplative prayer retreats. He has a Master of Divinity from Biblical Theological Seminary in Philadelphia and works as a freelance writer and editor. He and his wife have three children. You can connect with him at edsuzeski.com. Ed, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The new book is called Flee, Be Silent, Pray, Ancient Prayers for Anxious Christians. You grew up Catholic, right?
Yeah, for the first 12 to 15 years of my life, depending on how you count it.
It sounds like you were a really earnest Catholic.
No, I wasn't. Not at all. No, that's the funny thing. My dad started going to this, small fundamentalist Baptist church in New Jersey. And my mom, my family was pretty committed as Catholics, but it was also, I feel like, a kind of a cultural thing where it's like, you're part of this family, you're Catholic, like this is a Catholic family. And the Baptist church, it was, this is like a King James only, hymns only, shirt and tie church. And I thought it was awesome. Like, it was just amazing how the people sang the hymns, and they had cookouts with baseball, and they had Bible study, and they asked me what I thought about the Bible, and we had discussions about the Bible, and people prayed for me, and I just thought it was amazing, this wild, fun world of growing up Baptist. I just was so jealous of all the Baptists who were so lucky. And so that kind of drew me away from Catholicism initially. So I wasn't really an earnest Catholic. I actually started to read the Bible for myself and found it really exciting.
I grew up Baptist as well. And I think you're the first person to ever use the phrase, the wild world of growing up Baptist.
And so when I told the priest that I was going to this Baptist church, they were like really alarmed, and I can understand where they're coming from, because they were, it was end times theology. They were saying the Pope is, the devil. They even didn't like Billy Graham, which was kind of the last straw for my dad before we moved to a more evangelical church. But the priest tried to shut it down, and they tried to keep me from reading the Bible, and they said, no, just listen to the priest. And it's kind of funny, the Baptist church that didn't, you didn't go to movies, you didn't, all the restrictions. But to my mind, as a teenager, young teenager, it was the church that, encouraged me to read the Bible and to think and kind of gave me some freedom versus the Catholic Church, where they tried to shut down any questions or Bible study for me.
Well, the thing that made me say that you were an earnest Catholic was that story about wanting to read the Bible, which I should have said you were earnestly spiritual, seeking, seeking God. It sounds like, and that, like, that's part of your story, is the reaction to the priest in your parish reacting to you reading the Bible, right?
Right. Yeah. So in my mind, you have to remember too that I was listening to Christian radio, and my dad was had a plumbing business in Philadelphia. And he advertised on the local Christian radio station. So once he was kind of in that world, we had Christian radio on all the time. And you don't have to listen too long to Christian radio to kind of pick up like a persecution complex of like you're being, hunted, or people are trying to ban the Bible or whatever. So this effort by the priest to kind of keep me from reading the Bible fit into that narrative of you're being persecuted and they're trying to keep you from reading the Bible. And so I reacted really strongly against that attempt. So definitely a lot of earnest and anxiety there, for sure.
You came out of the Catholic Church with kind of a chip on your shoulder, it sounds like. And you had this other experience at the Fundamental Baptist Church, but then you went to an evangelical church, like you said. What happened after that? What's the rest of the story?
You know, so you immerse yourself in the Bible, and to me, I thought that's the best thing you could do with your life is just to devote yourself to learning the Bible and teaching the Bible to other people. And so I went to seminary, and along the way, I was, you know, marking up my Bible with my yellow highlighter anytime I found something that contradicted Catholic teaching or that I thought I could use against Catholics. There was definitely that adversarial relationship. But I really kind of went all in and was going to just be this, you know, Bible teacher. And I went to seminary and I started working at a church, and it just wasn't, it didn't provide the connection with God that I thought it would. And ministry wasn't what I thought it would be. And there was just a lot of disillusionment, and it was just disconcerting. And what I like to say is that I could translate the Bible in, you know, from Greek or Hebrew, but I didn't have words to pray. And so that was my moment of crisis, was realizing that I just didn't know where to begin with prayer. I didn't feel close to God, and kind of following the program didn't really work out. And so that's where I began to look for other ways to pray and approach God.
Anxiety has played a big role in your story as well. I mean, it's part of the title of the book. It sounds like that was something that had plagued you. Where did that come from?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that, you know, as an evangelical, I think it's kind of part of the movement in that we're always trying to like outdo each other or to prove ourselves. We're always trying to be, you know, the most committed. We're always trying to make sure we're doing enough for God. We're always, you know, I think we always feel like we aren't praying enough. We're not sharing the gospel enough. We're not reading enough Bible. We're not getting up early enough. There is that hardworking, kind of anxious unease that we just feel like we aren't, you know, we're saved by grace, but, you know, we actually have to really work really hard and kind of prove ourselves in some way, that there's kind of that contradiction in some of our practices. And, you know, that kind of worked in with some of my own just anxious issues, my issues with anxiety and experiences from earlier in my life kind of came out in the form of anxiety in my mid-20s. And I think that religion played into expanding that and making that a bigger issue, rather than helping me resolve it in peace with God and just mental rest and peace within myself as well. So I felt like in a lot of ways my spirituality that I kind of picked up in the evangelical movement only made things worse. It was always just, you know, trying to prove myself, trying to do one more thing. And at a certain point, you kind of just crack.
Yeah, there's a dichotomy in evangelicalism that preaches about truth and grace and even kind of resting in God's love, but also you should probably be reading your Bible more and praying more and doing this list of things more.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, evangelizing more. That was a big thing in seminary, was I had a class where they actually... the assignments were like sharing the gospel every week. You had to like write about that. You got graded on your reflections on sharing the gospel. Yeah. And you know, this is like a Campus Crusade guy who was like very casually bringing up people's, you know, eternal destinations over like ordering coffee at Starbucks. And for me, this like just completely freaked me out. And I remember waiting in line at Walmart and just having this panic attack because of this, like, why am I ashamed of the gospel? Why am I ashamed? Why can't I do this? And it becomes this guilt and this burden to bear. And it just kind of became this, like, this spiral for me.
I think my breathing became labored when I read that portion of the book.
Right.
Thinking about being forced to evangelize in that manner for school sounds just like my worst nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, I should have become a seminary dropout at that point. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was just thinking we're talking about, you know, the evangelical church. There's also a kind of anxiety machine within the moderate and progressive church too, which is that I've got to get busy working on, you know, everything, sex yeah. trafficking and global warming and refugees. And the list is so very long and can be very anxiety producing.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that Thomas Merton wrote about a lot, was the balancing that need for, and maybe he wouldn't have used the word balancing, but, you know, confronting that need to always do more, and almost the need to keep doing more things and to keep adding more things. It you know, can almost steal our inner peace, our grounding with God, and so we become kind of almost incapacitated in our ability to do good, because we stretch ourselves so thin that we need that grounding in God and that place of that love and that well to serve out of. And I think you can go either way. You can kind of go really like hard toward, you know, kind of creating your own inner zen, and it becomes very self-serving. And, you know, I think that's a problem as well. I think that's, you know, that those are the people who, you know, write to me and say, just stick to spirituality. Just tell me how to have peace. Hmm. And that can, you know, become self-serving. But the other end of things is that you can go too far toward solving all the world's problems and not grounding yourself in your identity as a loved child of God.
So things weren't really working for you. The spirituality that you had invested so much in wasn't working for you. How did you first encounter just this kind of contemplative stream of Christianity?
Yeah, it was really unlikely. There was a pastor at my seminary who at the time, this is, you know, maybe like 2003. It was when everyone was kind of experimenting with candles and prayer books. It was evangelical. Like I think there was that emerging church book I forget who wrote it now.
There was a whole cohort behind that kind of emerging church movement in the early 2000s, which is it's evolved a lot since then, kind of means something different. But yeah, I was totally completely fascinated by that when it came about.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they call, I think Spencer Burke called it the bells and smells, you know, but it was a church service that he hosted at a church, kind of like a mainline church, where he did the Jesus prayer and silence and all these different, you know, like Lectio Divina, all these practices that, you know, it's interesting. I feel like it came out at a time that it kind of appeared trendy, but these are these ancient practices that have a long history in the church. So they're not really trendy, but I think that people kind of use them in trendy ways. But he was honestly just a pastor trying to figure out something meaningful to do in church that he felt like just that had more weight than just the kind of the four hymns and then, you know, a sermon approach that had kind of become the template. And so he created this service, and I don't think it lasted very long. I went to one of them, and I remember doing the 10 minutes of silence, and we were supposed to do this Jesus prayer, you know, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And I remember after the 10 minutes of silence, it was agonizing. And I thought to myself, well, that didn't work. And kind of sunk it further into despair about how I was going to learn to pray. But what's interesting is that after that experience, it kind of made me curious about Lectio Divina and contemplation. And so I started to seek people out and to learn more about it. And another one of my classes, we had a conference call with Phyllis Tickle, and she's talking about the Catholics and how wonderful the Catholics are and how they influenced her Divine Hours prayer book. And that kind of, you know, threw up a little red flag for me. It was like, huh, like this, you know, Phyllis Tickle seems pretty legit and she's okay with the Catholics. So maybe I need to start learning from them a little bit. And that started to kind of open me up as I, you know, started to learn about these practices and hear how people have been using them, and that they had a history that went way, way back. You know, some of those prayers, like the Jesus prayer, went back to the the Desert Fathers and Mothers. So it wasn't even like a Catholic versus Protestant thing. It was just the roots of the church. And that began to really open me up beyond some of my misgivings about Catholicism.
So talk a little bit about the Divine Hours. That played a lot of the big role in kind of this transformation for you.
Yeah. I mean, for a while, Bible study was this thing where you read the Bible and you come out with information that you have your quote unquote your devotions. And it's really just information. It's writing it down in a journal and maybe you have a spiritual encounter, but you're really just trying to figure out like, what does the Bible say? And you're trying to apply it to your life, but it has a very information focused kind of almost transactional feel. And the Divine Hours arranges a series of Bible readings and prayers into its three different readings, morning, noon, and evening. They call it Vespers. And then there's a very short reading for like before bedtime called Compline. So it's basically three or four readings a day, depending on how you use it. Reading for each day. It's all organized by the church calendar. And the idea is you're basically praying with scripture and you're praying with these prayers that have been part of the church for generations. And so that became basically my main spiritual practice for a number of years. It became kind of a foundational thing. And even today, kind of part of my own little rule of life is I make space for praying the hours each day. It provides a grounding place for me. And ironically, I say that I'm reading the Bible devotionally instead of as devotions, which I think kind of gets at the difference of it's prayerfully reading the Bible and interacting with it and slowly letting it work on me in terms of transformation of being aware of God. And it's not about, I mean, maybe I'll come up with some ideas about what it means, but it isn't necessarily about more information. It's about more transformation.
You know, it took me a long time to realize the difference between reading the Bible for study and reading the Bible for devotion. And
right.
I think that's because within evangelicalism, even reading the Bible for quote unquote devotion is still reading it for study.
Right, right. That's exactly it. It gets all mixed up. Yep.
Do you still experience evangelicals giving a big pushback to these contemplative prayer practices?
I think I scared enough of them away back. So one of the interesting things that happened in my journey, this isn't quite related to the book, but I have family who are women in ministry. And so that became a big thing for me early on in my own just online presence was supporting women in ministry. I had a series on my old blog that was devoted to sharing the stories of women in ministry. And my premise was, I'm not going to try to convince you based on arguments in the Bible, because if you disagree with me, you can just look up what N.T. Wright has to say and fight with him. I'm not going to be able to help you there, but I will host a place to share the stories of women who are in ministry, who feel called by God, and you can interact with them and see what you think of that. And that, I think that kind of scared enough people away who would also be kind of like the overlap of people who would oppose women in ministry, who would also oppose contemplative prayer. There's a pretty big overlap there.
Sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
they kind of self-selected away from me. And the people who found me were more, were more open to other ways of praying and reading the Bible. And, this idea of reading the Bible devotionally and just being open to, I mean, the Psalms talk all the time about wait on the Lord or wait in silence or, my soul waits on God alone. Like that's such a big part of the Psalms. And Jesus is going off in the wilderness, praying all night. Like, does he talk all night? Like, no, I don't think so. I think he's in silence and he's being aware and present for God the Father. So I think that a lot of people who were open to that had already been, I'd already been reading my work. And so I've had very little pushback. Yeah, the odd comment every now and then that this isn't true, but I wrote a blog post a couple years ago that's, is contemplative prayer dangerous? And I just send them to that. And I used to think that. I mean, I listened to Christian radio where they said contemplation is dangerous and centering prayer is bad. And so I've listened to all those arguments and experienced all of that. So I feel like I can help people think through that if they want to think about that. But I've had very little pushback, because I think that more people who are looking at my books are the people who are anxious and burned out and trying to figure out how do I seek a loving God.
I mean, I think of my own journey, and I mentioned before that I grew up Baptist, and I don't remember anything overtly anti-Catholic, for instance.
Okay.
But so much of Baptist distinctives are kind of a reaction to Catholicism, like autonomy of the local church. So, you know, there's no top-down leadership, yep, and priesthood of all believers. So we don't need to go to confess to a priest. And those things are kind of like, seem specifically aimed at Catholic theology.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, and I'm not equating, and I don't think you do either, we're not equating contemplative practices with Catholicism. It's just that we learn most of them from Catholic thinkers. But by the time I went to college and a college minister introduced me to Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, which could, right, can kind of be like a gateway to, yeah, contemplative practices. Looking back, I'm kind of surprised that I wasn't suspicious of it. And rather, when I read that book, I remember it connecting so many dots for me, because I remember thinking, right, yeah, all of this is stuff that I read about in the Bible, but we never do. So, right, you know, meditation and fasting, like there was this sense that like, oh yeah, I think I knew I was supposed to be doing this stuff, but no one ever talked about actually doing it in real life today. It was just the stuff that people did in the Bible. And it was such a breath of fresh air for me. And there was no resistance to it at all. It was like, I've been looking for this for a long time. And I didn't really see it as in conflict with the stream of Christianity that I've been brought up with. And so, I don't know, I'm always curious about people who are so overly cautious about that and what it is from their background that produces, right, that in them.
I mean, it's probably just Christian talk radio. I mean, that's where I got, honestly, I mean, that's where I got a lot of that is, you know, Hank Hanegraaff and,
yeah,
all the different, you know, radio shows that kind of masquerade as, well, Christian, kind of politicized, and it's just something else to be afraid of.
Well, yeah, and I've really come to believe that fundamentalism isn't so much a set of beliefs, but a way and a posture in which we hold those beliefs. Because I really, for all of the theology that I've changed since I've grown up and gotten distance from the kind of stream that I grew up in, I still look back and I say it was a pretty loving place. And I think that goes a long way. Just the way in which we hold our beliefs and the posture that we have and humility, right, that those things really make a big difference.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely something, you know, the contemplative tradition is trying to pull us away from that defensiveness. I think that's kind of what you're getting at with the fundamentalism, is that there's a defensive us versus them posture, and it almost becomes, you know, either, you know, it becomes a win or lose scenario instead of, you know, trying to integrate more with people and to see what's in common with them. And I think that's kind of where the contemplative practices would lead us. And, you know, especially with the false self that we deal with, the illusions of ourselves. I think that, I mean, one of the things that I've talked about with people is that I think my own like evangelical identity became like a false self of something to like defend and hold on to. And that as I've kind of gone into contemplative spirituality, I don't think I've changed my theology that dramatically. I think it's just like you say, that how I interact with other people and my posture toward other people and being more compassionate and having less of a defensive mindset of I have to preserve or defend myself from something.
Let's talk about some of these actual practices. I had Aaron Nyquist was on here not that long ago, so we talked about his book. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And some of the, he talks about some of these practices as well. Let's start with the prayer of examine. Just real quick, give a brief description of what that is and how someone would do that.
Sure. Yeah. It's you can get apps to help you with this. That's how I started it. So, one spells it correctly, examine, and then one's more of like examine, like examine. But the basic premise is that you learn to become aware of God, that you pause and reflect on God's presence in your day, and you look back and you consider where God was. And so you might just go through your day step by step, you know, waking, you know, noontime, evening, and just reflect on where you thought God was. And there's different questions people ask. Like I like the idea of reflecting back on what's encouraging, you know, what's something where I'm thankful for, and then and looking at what am I not thankful for, what am I discouraged by. And then you look ahead to tomorrow and consider how to pray based on those reflections. And so it's really just a matter of either at the end of your day or at the beginning of your day, looking back at, you know, the previous 24 hours or so, or 12 hours, and considering just where God was and what God might be doing. And it's kind of like almost like self-directed spiritual direction a little bit, in that you're just reflecting on where God is and where the invitations might be to move forward. And some practices suggest maybe taking 5 minutes of just silence afterwards, just to be present for God. And interestingly, Saint Ignatius, who was the person who gets credited with kind of starting the examine as a practice, when he taught his followers the examine, he said that this should be the one thing you do, that if there's one thing you do in your spiritual life, do this. Which, as an anxious evangelical, that's like, what? Like, that's so lazy. You're just thinking about your day. That's not going to move the ball forward. That's not going to make me holier. But the genius of it is that it prompts you to reflect on your day and then to pray about it. And so if there is something that maybe is keeping you from prayer, or if you've had a difficult situation, it forces you to confront that and think about it and then to pray on it. So I like that mentality of having the examine as kind of a foundational discipline. And what I found too is that it's a lot easier to pray in silence after doing the examine, because it kind of digs up some of the stuff that might be, kind of beneath the surface that might get in the way as I try to pray. So it is kind of like a nice preemptive action before prayer.
You bring up a good point, because I'd always thought of the prayer of examine as a standalone prayer, which it can very well be, but you kind of use it as a kind of pretext for other prayer to prepare yourself for other types of prayer.
Yeah, I mean, that's just my own, my own failure over the years. If you struggle to sit in silence long enough and then you figure out like, hey, there's a way to deal with some of my distracting thoughts. It was a lifeline for me.
I don't know any modern person who doesn't deal with distraction and centering their thoughts. It's a hard one.
Yeah, that's what I ask people at the Contemplative Writer website. What's your greatest struggle for prayer? Very open-ended question. It was almost overwhelmingly hundreds of people saying distracting thoughts, almost word for word, distracting thoughts.
So let's move on to the centering prayer. How does that work?
Yeah. Yeah. So, so the book title is Flee, Be Silent, Pray. So the premise is of withdrawing. So taking a step back from kind of the cares of life, entering into silence in some capacity, and then praying. And so centering prayer is one method of praying in silence. It's not the only way. People do lots of different things, but just based on talking to people who struggle with these distracting thoughts, centering prayer is kind of an elegant solution to the distracting thoughts we have when we enter into silence before God. And so the presumption is that God is present, God is loving. You don't have to do any kind of say any kind of special word to make God appear. God's already present, and that you're already present with God. Like, you can't move away from God. God's not moving away from you. The issue is oftentimes that there's some kind of distracting thoughts a lot of times, or kind of mental clutter is another word people use. And so centering prayer uses a prayer word or phrase to kind of occupy the mind, to kind of give it something to do, kind of like here's a ball to bounce or something like that. And then that lets you become present with God and let go of the thoughts. And so that's really the idea, is that you're releasing the thoughts away by using a prayer word. And then you're just being still and silent before God. And it's not about having spectacular results or epiphanies or revelations. And you might have that, but the centering prayer, the word, is simply just a way to not get trapped in kind of rehashing your thoughts and thinking about things. And so a prayer word, like just the name of Jesus or the word beloved or that Jesus prayer, it just gives your mind something to do when you're trying this to be still before God. And it's really effective once you learn it and practice it, but it does take practice.
I really don't want to miss like what this did for you personally, because you really make a point to draw out how you were kind of at the end of your spiritual rope, it seemed, when you found this, in that faith had become really dry and almost non-existent, but this really saved you in a few ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, not to take a shot at other traditions of prayer, or different ways of praying or approaching God, but I definitely was exposed to a lot of charismatic theology and prayers. And I'm open to that. I'm not opposed to it. But it also left me kind of almost more anxious, because I wasn't having these amazing encounters with God. And people were saying, like, it's okay. Like, you know, God shows up in different ways and don't, you know, but it's still disconcerting to see people who are like having these like words of revelation from God, and I'm going to pray and I just feel like my words are bouncing off the ceiling. And I think there was a lot of performance and a lot of just trying to prove myself, prove God, probably going back and forth. Some days I was trying to just prove God was real, and some days I was trying to prove that my faith was real. And this took me out of that downward spiral, and it gave me a place of just faith where I could say, God is already here. I don't have to like summon God. I don't have to say, come Lord, come down and show us your favor or whatever. It wasn't like summoning God or saying the magic word. It was more a matter of just being present for a God who's already lovingly here. And that gave me a much firmer starting point. And I had a very profound, just sense of peace starting out with this form of prayer. And it's not like I get that every time, but there was a sense that God was, you know, that God was meeting me in that time. And I've let go of that desire to perform or to prove myself or prove God. And I think that this has given me just a practice, kind of like a stable place to just begin spiritually every day, that regardless of the results or what I think, it's just a matter of just showing up and being present for God, because God's present. So I just need to remove some of the mental clutter to kind of get out of the way and be present for God's love.
It's funny that you mention the charismatic stream, because I've always felt that, although maybe the methods are very different, these seem to be trying to get at the same thing, which is just a connection with God,
right?
And making God real. And it's always seemed to me that those two, kind of the contemplative stream, the charismatic stream, really had more in common than we admit.
Yeah. And that's actually, interestingly enough, I mean, that's a big thing in the vineyard right now. I was in a vineyard church in Columbus, Ohio for a number of years, where they were basically training up an enormous cohort of people to be spiritual directors and doing centering prayer. And this was a really big part of their mission and their ministry, was to have spiritual direction. And so I think there is a lot in common with the charismatic stream and with the contemplative stream. And I think that the place where I got tripped up was kind of the performance aspect, or the kind of the summoning God and believing that I needed to please God or make God present or manifested in some way. And once I got kind of pulled out of that mindset, I mean, I feel like I still would consider myself quote unquote charismatic in my beliefs, but my practices are just very simple, and there isn't a lot to it.
Well, and you make a good point in the book that any tool from any stream of Christianity can be abused and right. has been. Yeah. And even the in contemplative prayer, repetition is a part of it. But if it's, you know, mindless or performative, then that can be abused as well. And we all know, I think, instances where just the Bible itself has been abused.
Right. Right. There's no one saying that we shouldn't read the Bible because people misinterpret it, right?
Right, I mean, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, I think with centering prayer, it is a little counterintuitive. I think that's the big barrier people have to kind of get through, is that you're learning to release thoughts, and it's not necessarily that you're thoughtless, it's that you're just trying to be present for God and not get swept away by your worries. And, you know, this is just a really practical thing in life, where if someone offends you, or if you hear a terrible story in the news, or if you have an argument on social media, I mean, you can spend a lot of time going over and over again in your mind what just happened. And learning to let go of a thought is a really, really important spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. So beyond prayer, just learning to recognize when a thought has kind of camped out in your mind and taken up residence, that's big. Like, just to let go of that thought is a spiritual discipline. And so that's one of the, you know, I try to avoid promising people like outcomes and results, because centering prayer is not focused on that. It's just focused on being present and letting whatever happens happen. But I think that what I've seen over the years is that I've become better at recognizing when I'm obsessing over something, or when I kind of an afflicting thought has kind of become bigger than warranted in my mind. I do have some resources now to let go of those thoughts.
So I mentioned in your bio that you lead these prayer retreats. Walk me through what happens on those prayer retreats. What do you do?
Yeah, so this is something that I've done for a number of years now, and we've kind of changed it so that it happens the day before the Festival of Faith and Writing. But it's a retreat. It's a prayer retreat for writers. Basically, it's we call it Renew and Refine, and the vision was to provide a mix of professional support for writers, but also spiritual support, because I think that just a lot of really toxic things can get in the way of writing today. And yet writing can also be a really deeply spiritual practice, because it does rely on observation, on being present and not letting distractions kind of pull you in a lot of different directions. There is kind of like a focus involved. And so as I've practiced contemplative prayer and also just dealing with the false self and just, you know, how we measure our worth, there are so many different aspects of writing that touched on spirituality. And so I started this Renew and Refine retreat with a couple other friends, and have had different guests come and speak or share. And we have times of silence. We have times of meditating on scripture, where we do like a Lectio Divina. A lot of times what we'll do is we'll do like a scripture reading that's like a Lectio Divina style. And I'll suggest maybe a word from that could be used as a centering word. So one year we did the 23rd Psalm, and we used the word shepherd. I suggested, you know, people could use whatever word they wanted, but I suggested, let's take 15 minutes and just sit with the word shepherd and just see where that leads you. And, you know, we've had other people lead different breakout sessions just to talk about their experiences with prayer and with writing and social media. I mean, social media is such a huge issue for people today. So there's just a lot of different ways that spirituality intersects with the world of writers, of social media. And then we end the retreat with a time of affirmation of God's love, and reminding people that they are God's beloved children. And so we're trying to give people some practices to use, but also kind of like a reorienting moment to remember that they're God's beloved children, that their worth doesn't come from their social media following or their readership. And a number of people have said it's just a powerful reminder before going to the Festival of Faith and Writing, where it feels like, you know, you go up to a publisher and they say, what's your social media follower count? What are your sales like? You know, it's like, it's instantly like numbers, results, you know, different metrics for measuring your worth. So that's, you know, we've had it at other times and places, but that in particular has been a really powerful experience.
That's so cool. It's so amazing how something so quote unquote basic is being reminded how loved we are by God and how valued we are. Yeah. Something that we learned way back in Sunday school can be so transformative still.
Yeah. Yeah. And the funny thing about the retreat, you know, we were just experimenting with different ways to do that. I mean, it started out with the number of us walked around from person to person and gave them that affirmation. But this year, the past year we did it, we had each person turn to the person next to them and say it to them. So they received it, but they also gave it. Mm. And it was almost more powerful for me to be forced to, you know, say that to someone. And I think that, you know, that a lot of times we can imagine, well, God loves this person, sure, but does God really love me?
That's right.
And so when you're forced to say it to someone else, because I think we all kind of believe that, but then when we hear someone else say it back to us, I think we can maybe receive it a little easier. At least that happened for me.
I wonder what somebody who reads this book and they want to get started with a contemplative spiritual life, what would be like the next resource that you would direct them to? I know you mentioned explorefaith.org in the book. That seems like a pretty easy one to go to.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different directions you can go. Thankfully, a lot of the, you know, contemplative prayer teachers that I quote from are available like on YouTube. So you could look up Cynthia Bourgeau, you could look up Thomas Keating or Richard Rohr, you could look up their teachings. You know, there are different, I don't want to give you too much competition here, but there's Lisa DeLay's podcast, Spark My Muse, where she has a lot of contemplative folks on. I'm sure you've had some people on too, who could help. So I really like the book by Martin Laird. It's called Into the Silent Land. He really breaks it down really easily. He's really into using the Jesus prayer. And so I will recommend this book with a caveat that I have a spiritual director, so I recommend exploring that as a possibility, getting a spiritual director maybe once a month, just meeting with someone to guide you through some of these practices and to learn them. I mean, that's what monks do in the monasteries, is they have spiritual directors and they help them process things and apply things. And as we were kind of processing things that would be helpful for me, you know, we felt like maybe the Jesus prayer isn't the best thing for me to use right now for centering. So with anything that you read or do, I think there's a measure of just wisdom and of just, I don't want to say customization, but you know, you need to just figure out where you're at, where God needs to meet you. And I saw this, I taught a class, a Sunday school class on this at my church. And there are people who had really toxic childhoods in the church. And, you know, I start the book out with a lot about the love of God and kind of countering some of the judgmental, angry views of God people have. But she still felt like just her experience of God had been so negative. It was really hard to practice centering prayer because she didn't feel like she could trust God, because it is a very trusting, faith-filled practice. It's not something where you have a lot of evidence to go on. You're just leaping off in the faith, trusting that God is present and loving and aware of you and present. So if you don't have that foundation, then it's going to be hard. So everyone's going to start in a different place. So a spiritual director can help with that. But I really like Martin Laird's book, Into the Silent Land, just for teaching some basic practices. And I feel like he breaks it down really well. And if you look for him online, he has even some videos where he's, I think it's, I don't know, PBS did a documentary or someone did a video series, some major news channel of him, and you can find that. So there is a lot of stuff online. Explore Faith has the Divine Hours, And Ignatian spirituality has the basic examine practice as well.
That's great. I'll try to link to those things that you mentioned in the show notes to this episode. If people just want to go to that one place, they can find all this stuff there. I'll do the work for you.
You take a picture of the back page of the book.
That's right. Yeah, that'd be the easiest way. Yeah. Let's assume people have the book. They can go there themselves and look at them.
There we go. Yeah, buy the book.
I think that's one of the most wonderful things about some of the stuff you were mentioning. One of the wonderful things about contemplative prayer is that this isn't codified, meaning we can change these things to fit kind of where we are in life and adapt. And it's encouraging and beautiful to remember that at some point, some people just made these prayers up. And I mean that in a really wonderful, beautiful way. They're God-given creativity and communion with God produced these prayers, and we kind of have the freedom to do the same. And that's really beautiful.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, when you think about what spiritual formation is, I had a really funny experience reading a book called The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg.
Yeah.
And I remember reading his book, and I had been reading a bunch of Merton at the time. And I was like, this is everything he's talking about is what monks do. It's just habit formation. It's really simple, basic habit formation. That's how they pray, you know?
Yeah.
And that really helped me, because it's like, this is just kind of a hack. You know, you're just hacking this stuff together. And, you know, if the thought of 10 minutes of silence or 20 minutes of silence sounds awful, and if you've read, but, you know, someone's saying you need to at least have 20 minutes of silence a day, like start with 2, start with 5, and just build on that, because that's just what the habit formation people say, is just go for an easy win, something you can do, and then you'll grow and you'll learn and you'll learn what it means to feel healthy, and you'll kind of develop these things almost like muscles. And so it's like people made this stuff up and adapted it, and then, you know, to learn it, you can also kind of put the training wheels on to kind of get the hang of it first. Like it's not a sink or swim issue for me.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like when I've gotten out of the habit of prayer and contemplative prayer, when I get back into it, I feel like the first couple of rounds are just kind of detox. If that makes sense. Like,
right.
I'm just kind of acclimating my brain to doing it again. And once I do that, I can kind of feel more connected in those times.
Yeah, definitely there is a sense of your mind needing to kind of get rid of some of the clutter that's kind of accumulated.
Well, Ed, it's been so good to get to talk with you. Thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.